as Justice Sears and Kerr are both well aware, last fall, if you were driving on freeways in or highways in Georgia, you may have noticed some billboards saying, get married, stay married. And also saying, children do better with parents together or for children's sake. And I understand from Kurt that there were other statements that were considered for these billboards, but these were the ones that were chosen. And maybe we can hear about some of the ones later that they chose not to put up. These billboards were sponsored by the Georgia Supreme Court with money paid for by the Georgia Bar Foundation and space that was donated by the Outdoor Advertising Association of Georgia. And our guest, Justice Sears, was reported as saying that she hoped the billboards would help bring down divorce and crime rates and push fathers to stay involved in their children's lives, which seemed like laudable goals. I think these billboards provide just one example of the state's role in promoting marriage, and one that we can talk about, although we can talk about many other ways the state might do that as well, and I'll try to outline some of those. I wanted to just use my few minutes to set out what I thought are two key questions we could talk about today. One is marriage actually good for people? And two, if it is, what should the state's role be in supporting it, and how should the state go about that? Because even if it is good for people, it still might be something that people think of as private and not something the state should be involved in. So first, on the question of is marriage good for people, there are numerous studies, in fact, a flood of social science studies that have come out in recent years indicating that people who were married are happier, wealthier, better parents, more stable than people who aren't. Married men especially seem to benefit from being married. Single men have a 250% higher mortality rate than married men. Married women, the same study showed, single women have a 50% higher mortality rate than married women, so marriage seems to help women as well, but not as much as men. Married men are more likely to have a higher income, more likely to be able to keep their jobs, more likely to show up for work on time. Again, as for women, it's a little less clear how great the benefits are. Married women make 4 to 10% more if they work than single women do, but they also do 12 hours more per week of uncompensated household labor. Apparently, having a man in the house makes a mess. I don't know. And so it's unclear how that pans out for women. Marriage also seems to be correlated with better parenting. Kids who are children of married parents do better on a variety of metrics. They're less likely to be poor. They're more likely to have high self-esteem. They're more likely to do well on standardized tests. They're less likely to have behavioral problems. So a lot of these studies seem to indicate that marriage is really good for men, a little bit good for women, and really, really good for children. And if that's the case, we might think that the state would want to support marriage. So why would people say that marriage isn't a good thing? The biggest criticisms of these studies tend to fall in I would say, three camps. Or three arguments. One is that correlation is not causation. So, yes, married people may have all these great attributes, but that may be also why they got married, right? So people who are wealthy are more likely to attract a mate who wants to marry them. Or people who are happy may be more attractive. And so it's even though you have all these statistics showing you that there are correlations, you can't necessarily assume that someone who gets married will suddenly take on all of these characteristics that they didn't have before. The second is that these studies rely on averages that may not be true for specific populations, right? So on average, for example, kids who are children, let me just give you a few examples that I wrote down here from some of the studies. Kids living with their biological parents seem to do better, with both biological parents seem to do better on all these metrics than single mothers, but children whose single mothers remarry don't necessarily do better with a stepfather in the house. White children whose mothers remarry actually have more behavioral problems once a stepdad gets introduced. Black children whose mothers remarry do not have more behavioral problems once a stepfather is introduced, which makes you think that there are different things going on in different populations that might make us think that one size fits all might not work. There's also a recent study done about self-esteem among kids who are children of single mothers. And children whose single mothers were white were more likely to have low self-esteem and behavioral problems than children whose white mothers were married. But children whose single mothers were black didn't show a difference in self-esteem and behavioral problems. the variable that seemed to account for the difference there was religiosity of the mother. Right? The more often the mother went to church, the higher the self-esteem and the fewer behavioral problems. But whether she was married or not didn't make a difference at all. So again, we might not want to extrapolate from studies that take a broad look at the population and say we can fix problems in particular communities based on this, on these studies, if it doesn't hold true for those communities. And then finally, and this is something that was alluded to in the remarks before I started talking, we might think about feasibility in terms of the marriage market, right? So you have to be able to find a mate, right? And we have, I mean, you could argue about the reasons that this is true, right? But as of 2003, about 10% of the African-American male population in their 20s were incarcerated. There are more young black men in jail than in college. It may be that some women are saying, I'd like to get married, but who am I supposed to marry? And it may be that in that case, marrying someone who's incarcerated may not actually give all the benefits that all these studies about marriage say, right? So we'd have to think about the feasibility of encouraging marriage if we wanted to. So those are just some comments on the debate over whether marriage is a good thing across the board. Assuming for the moment that it is, or assuming that it's good enough that we might want to promote it, how would the state go about doing that? What branch of government should do that? At what point in a marriage? Is it at the entry into marriage, or is it the exit that the state wants to try to either make it easier to get married, or harder to get married, or harder to get divorced? How would we go about doing this? And I think the first question we have to ask is, what's the state's interest in doing this? Because that might affect our answer. So one interest the state might have is in preventing poverty or preventing the state from having to pay for poverty, right? So if a married couple is going to be able to pool resources and be more likely to be wealthier, it's apparently not true that two can live as cheaply as one, but some folks have said more like 1.5, but still it may be useful for people to be able to pool resources, but also in a long-term committed relationship, more likely if one person's not doing well that the other can pick up the slack. So the state may have an interest in just keeping people from needing state-sponsored welfare because they can support each other. The state might also have a strong interest in protecting kids. If kids, on the whole, do better with married families, we might want to encourage people to stay married, even if the couple themselves isn't that happy, right? The kids might be happier. A lot of studies have shown that in low-conflict marriages, kids are better if their parents stay together, even if their parents don't like each other very much, right? If it's a high-conflict marriage, then the kids are better off if the parents divorce. So the state's interest might be in protecting kids. Justice Sears had said some interesting things in the media that I hadn't really thought of before about the state's interest in just dealing with the caseload that these divorce cases, mostly divorce and some custody cases, create. According to some of the news reports I read, 65% of the civil cases in Georgia heard at the Superior Court level are some sort of fragmenting family cases, and that outnumbers all of the felony and misdemeanor criminal cases combined. But, yeah, right. So if you're thinking about, you know, what's the another interest the state had, that's incredibly expensive. Courts could be doing other things. Courts are backlogged with these cases. If some people would stay together rather than fighting these cases out in court, that might be helpful to the state as well. So if those are the state's interests, what could the state do? Well, one possibility is just messages, billboards, right? Just tell people that marriage is a good thing. I mean, the billboards are pretty compelling. There's a picture of a really cute, happy baby. And, you know, get married, stay married. It resonates with you, right? Like, it would be good for this child to have two parents who are involved in its life. You could also use something more coercive, or before we get too coercive, you could use something like a gift, a carrot. You know, think of carrots and sticks, right? You could say, we're going to give you tax incentive to get married. We're going to not kick you out of entitlement programs if you get married. So you're not going to lose your federally subsidized something if you marry. In terms of something even more coercive, stick, we might say, we're not going to protect you if you're not married. So cohabitation isn't going to get any sort of legal status here. If you want the benefits of marriage, you're going to have to be married. We're not going to have any other sort of institution or quasi-institution that will cover this. We also could, on the back end, on the divorce end, say, if you have children, we're going to make divorce harder to get. There'll be a longer waiting period if you have kids, or we're going to require some sort of counseling if you have kids before we'll give you a divorce. State involvement could also involve support. It could involve premarital counseling for free. right? If we want people to stay married, we might think people who walk into marriage with an understanding of the possible difficulties that might lie ahead might do better at staying in a relationship. A lot of states have taken that tack by reducing the license fee if the couple can demonstrate that they've gone through premarital counseling. So marriage is cheaper for you, and people who might otherwise not be able to afford counseling think, well, I have to pay the fee anyway, so if I could pay it into counseling instead, that's better for me. We also might want to think about access. One way, if you think marriage is good, one way that states might be able to improve things is to let more people get married. This isn't self-evident to a lot of people. Many people that are for marriage promotion are not for opening marriage up to, say, same-sex couples, right? But if you think that we want to make marriage special and cohabitation or civil unions or something else doesn't carry the same kind of social and cultural weight, we might just want to say, let's just have marriage, but make marriage for everyone. And finally, this is where I start to go off the deep end, maybe. But if we really are committed to this idea of marriage, we might want to think about those marriage market issues, right? We might want to think about maybe the way to get people to marry is to get rid of some of our more draconian drug laws, right? Like maybe a totally indirect means of promoting marriage might be to make there a bigger pool of available people, maybe supporting communities so that more people are in a position where they are attractive as mates is better than a tax incentive, for example, to marry. And finally, actually one of my students who's here, but I won't name them unless they choose to be named later, suggested this the other day, that part of the issue here may be that some people are more able to, or more willing, and we could debate which, to marry interracially. And one reality we may be dealing with here is that Black women are the least likely group to outmarry, to marry outside their group. So what should the state be doing? I mean, maybe it's not just get married, stay married on the billboards. Maybe it's consider people of other races. So I think all of these ideas might help us to think about how involved do we really want the state to be? Some of these are much more intrusive than others. And even if the state has these very legitimate reasons to want to be promoting marriage, we might want to think about how and why. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Justice Sears. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It really is a pleasure to be here. I have, my 30 pages of prepared remarks, but I'll tell you guys, I am so exhausted. I'm just happy to be here. What I think I'll do, because I think you set it up really beautifully, is tell you, Kurt, you can hand out my remarks. I think we emailed that to you today. And for those who are interested in reading them, and also you can go on the Georgia Supreme Court website, and we've got a beautiful white paper, and you can just click on that. And I've written tons on this now, but what I'll do is just kind of tell you how I got involved in this, and I prefer to have more of a dialogue about this. But before I do, I want to say two things. First, Kurt actually was the person who ended up with the Get Married, Stay Married slogan with the little billboard. I ran those by him. Naturally, we're getting a number. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Some people view it as a really far right-wing kind of thing, and I have to say no, no, and some people see it as a very liberal thing. But let me just tell you how I got involved in all this. One, before I go further, this is Charles, stand up. This is one of your distinguished graduates. He is a former justice of the Virginia Supreme Court. His portrait's out in the hall. I just saw it for the first time, Charles. He was a graduate of UVA in, what, 65? Just kidding, Charles. Okay. I know. Okay. And he has been good enough. He's a partner at Hunton and Williams and was good enough to drive up from Richmond. And yeah, he could drive. Yeah, so we're having a little bit of a family reunion, right? But thank you for coming, Charles. I became Chief Justice about 4 years ago, and the first thing I did was I was the first female Chief Justice of the state of Georgia. And what I did was start looking at the caseload figures for all of the cases in the state. And I was really shocked. I had been, I'd moved up fairly quickly through the ranks of the judiciary. I started as a traffic court judge when I was 27 years old. I graduated from Emory. I have a degree from UVA, as a matter of fact, an LLM in appellate studies, but graduated, started at Alston and Byrd, started at the traffic court when I was 27, ran for office, got a superior court judgeship at 32, and was appointed by Zell Miller at 36 years old. So I was a 36-year-old justice on the court. And I noticed that by the time I moved up to chief justice, and that took about 16 years, I'm 53 now, that between 1992, when I came on the court, and 2005, when I became chief justice, the caseload of domestic-type cases had gone from about 20% to 60%. And when I look at domestic cases, I'm including custody, alimony, divorce, all the child juvenile dysfunction type. I put them all in one category, and I started thinking, this is not good. I also started doing a lot of reading. I was born in 1955, and in that year, 20% of African-American children were born outside of wedlock. But today, 70% of African-American children are born outside of wedlock, and that's it's also really gone forward with white children and Hispanic children. I think it's like 46%. It's really, really quadrupled, and I couldn't figure out why, because I know things weren't any easier in 1955 than they are in 2009. There aren't more troubles for blacks, you know, incarceration rates notwithstanding. You know, it would seem to me that we have a little bit more going for us. And it just seemed that there were things that we weren't doing right. More men not committing fully to their families, and more women not willing to make men commit to them and then their children. And I just think it's a really stupid kind of mating strategy, because I believe that men are important to children, as important to children as women are important to children. And I just, all these single mothers going around, I can do it on my own. I can do it on my own, as the juvenile justice system just builds up with children who really are obviously having problems, is not a good thing. You know, so I decided to do something about it. And in 2005, I started the Georgia State Supreme Court Commission on Marriage, Children, and Families. And it's a statewide commission, and we're doing all these kinds of things. We're putting up billboards. We had the first big national summit in November where we got people to come down and to talk about fatherlessness and single parenting and all kinds of issues that are related to the problems that we're finding in the court system that are directly related to families not coming together and staying together. You know, all too often the blame is put on government. You know, there's not enough welfare money, or not enough this, or not enough this, or not enough that. But my position has been, if families can come together and stay together, that's the best anti-poverty child welfare program that we have, and that we can do it ourselves, and that we need to stop sticking our head in the ground and look to ourselves to do something about it. I'm very passionate about it. I've spent, not only with all the other chiefly duties that I have, put a lot of time and effort into this, and I'll be retiring from the court this June and be taking a grant, at least part-time, to continue doing some of this work. So I look forward to the questions and answers I gave you. I think probably a quick snapshot of why I'm into this and why I anticipate staying into this effort. If things are turning around slowly, and I'm glad to see that. So. All right, with that said, I look forward to the Q&A. Thank you.
Q&A. I feel like we should just open it up right now. That was wonderful. I'll try to make do with what thunder I have remaining after such wonderful opening presentations. Well, what time do we go to? We just keep going till it's over, huh? Okay. So let me try to. Hold on a second. Sorry here. I'm trying to use technology. This is always embarrassing when you come from Silicon Valley and you have trouble with technology. But we're gonna get this together. Here we go. Okay. So thank you, Kurt, for organizing. It is a great pleasure to be here. It is a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chief Justice Sears, Professor Abrams. This is a wonderful time and a great event. So thank you for organizing. I think I was here last year in Virginia. And when I think about February and March, I think back to last February and March, and something really unusual was happening for me then, which is that for the first time ever, I had many law students come to me after class and tell me that they would not be in class the following week, or that they would miss, you know, two or three or four or five classes, right? Last spring was horrible for attendance. And the reason was because people were going to Nevada and Iowa and all sorts of other states to work on one or the other presidential campaigns in the primary. At Stanford, people were very excited about a politician named Barack Obama. And I have probably a dozen students who left school to traipse all over the country working for the Obama campaign. Their excitement was part, of course, of an excitement that our entire nation has experienced over this past year, culminating in the election of Barack Obama as our 44th president. One aspect of the excitement surrounding the election, though, took me by surprise. I remain surprised at how many people came to me, and still do, to remark about the marriage between Barack and Michelle. Just in the last day, three people, unsolicited, said, "Well, isn't that something, Barack and Michelle, a black couple? They're now the first family. This is unprecedented. Not simply that we haven't had someone like them as president in the White House, but unprecedented in the sense that we don't have very many images of families like that." So people repeatedly express surprise, and then some express pleasure, and some express yearning that this is an image that they would like to see replicated, but they don't feel is replicated. And their implicit contrast, of course, is the image of Barack and Michelle Obama against single families, single parent families, and high rates of divorce among African Americans in particular. When people come to me and they talk about Barack and Michelle, I have to agree that we are a long way from the idealized marriages that they symbolize. We are a very long way from that. African Americans have the lowest marriage rate of any demographic group in this society. And I could probably take all of the time here and talk about various statistics, but I won't do that because they all tell the same story. African Americans are the least likely to marry, most likely to divorce, least likely to remarry. At every step, there's a disparity. The one statistic that I find the most gripping is that African-American women are three times as likely as white women to never marry. 90 to 95% of white women will eventually marry. Only 70% of black women are projected to ever marry. This is a startling statistic. One might think that the so-called gap in marriage is a matter of the precipitous drop-off in the rates of marriage among the so-called underclass. Right? These are the people that William Julius Wilson and others have written about in the inner cities of places like Chicago and Cleveland and Philadelphia and Detroit. These are inner cities where marriage, in fact, has almost disappeared. Marriage is extraordinarily uncommon, as upwards of three-quarters of all African-American children are born without their parents being married. That is remarkable. But the marriage gap is not limited to the underclass. You also see, and this is less known, but you also see a substantial gap in marriage among the middle class. If you look at African-American women who graduate college, for example, compared to white women who graduate college, they're twice as likely to never marry. And we could also have similar statistics for likelihood of divorce and likelihood of remarriage. So there's a racial gap in marriage that exists among the underclass, but it is nearly as substantial as the gap. That gap is nearly as substantial if we look only at middle class people. Even more, and this is a gap that Professor Abrams has usefully illuminated as likely, perhaps obviously, caused by a shortage of men. When you have more than a million African-American men in jail or prison across the nation or otherwise disabled by the criminal justice system so that they're not very marriageable, it might not be surprising that many of the women who would be their partners remain unmarried. There's just a shortage of men. But the marriage gap doesn't stop there. Even more surprising, what we find is that there's a marriage gap when we look at men as well. Now, you might expect that if there's a shortage of men, that the men who are remaining would be especially likely to get married, right? You would think that, well, the women are unmarried, but there's a shortage of men, so of course the men are married. But in fact, that's not what we find. Again, at every point in the socioeconomic spectrum, from men who earn $0 to $5,000 to $50,000 to $100,000 to $200,000, we find a racial gap in marriage. So the men who are in short supply are less likely to marry than their white counterparts. That's extraordinary. Even more surprising, though, is that African-American men show a different marital pattern than all other groups of men. A traditional observation about the relation between income and marriage for men is that the more income a man makes, the more likely the man is to marry. And this is there's a lot of intuitive reasons why that might be so, right? As my aunts used to tell my sisters, it is easy to love a rich man as a poor one. Right? And the message was clear, right? As easy to love a rich man as a poor one. And this is one of those sociological findings, right, that has been replicated so consistently that sociologists have, in fact, ceased to study the relationship between income and marriage for men, right? Higher-earning men are more likely to marry than lower-earning men. What's unusual, though, with African-American men is that we find that that pattern does not hold. For African-American men, the higher-earning groups of African-American men are actually less likely to marry than some lower-earning groups. Let me repeat that. African-American men, and we could look at use the graduates of a place like University of Virginia Law School as an example, right? People who earn as much money as UVA law school graduates earn if not at graduation, then a few years later. It'll come. Don't worry. People who earn that much money are men. African-American men are less likely to marry than African-American men who earn as much as college graduates, say, who didn't go to law school. Right, to put it in terms of the census categories that we might use, African-American men who earn $150,000 a year are less likely to marry than African-American men who earn $70,000 a year. So for white men, Asian men, Latino men, all other groups of men, the relationship between income and marriage is linear, right? If I had a board here, we would show it going up like that. But for black men, what you find is that the relationship is curvilinear. It goes up, and then it dips. And that's really perplexing. So, oh, then we can talk more about why that is. But for now, let me just emphasize that the racial gap in marriage is very substantial. And for African Americans, it's something that is difficult to not be aware of, even if one hasn't studied it. And once you study it and you see the full dimensions of that gap, it makes you just sit down and say, wow. Part of that, one question we should ask here is why, or whether we should care about the gap in marriage. And this is what Professor Abrams has wonderfully highlighted, this issue, right? I mean, maybe there's people choose to live in different ways, and, you know, whose business is that other than theirs? If I decide that I want to go bowling on Friday night, I should be able to go bowling on Friday night, right? Who cares why I do that? If I decide that I don't want to marry, then I should be able to be single. And neither my friends nor the government should be able to tell me otherwise. So one question is, well, why should we care, right? Why should society care about decisions that people make regarding marriage? And the typical response is that, well, as Professor Abrams says, marriage is correlated with a variety of beneficial outcomes. For adults, marriage is correlated with health and wealth and income and social connection and all sorts of other things. For children, it's associated with a wide array of positive outcomes, too, generally. But, of course, there's a problem of recognizing that correlation does not equal causation. And I won't say too much about some of this, because we've already had some of these issues put on the table. But let me just describe it in a slightly different way. The correlation does not equal causation problem is what we might call, what an empiricist would call, a sample selection problem. Right, so we have good outcomes that are associated with marriage statistically. And then the question is, well, did marriage really cause those outcomes? Or are those outcomes perhaps the result of some other characteristic that is associated with marriage? Right, so marriage is associated with higher earning for men. Men who earn more are more likely to be married. And that could be because marriage makes you earn more in some way. Or it could just be because, well, the guys who earn more are more likely to get married. Right? I mean, that could be what's happening there. And the fact that there's a correlation doesn't tell us anything about a result that's produced by marriage. So the sample selection problem, again, and we can have the same argument about health even. I'll take something that's even less intuitive. Right, I mean, there are a lot of studies that show that marriage is positively related to good health outcomes, but it could be that people who are chronically ill are just not very attractive partners, right? So they're not likely to marry because they're chronically ill, but it's sort of hard to study that if you're the researcher, but if you're dating the guy, you're going to figure that out, right? That he always has this back problem, and you don't want to be with someone who has a back problem, so you don't pursue that relationship. Not that anyone here would make a decision on such a trivial basis, right? But, so there's this problem of sample selection, and the sample selection problem is really, really, really hard for researchers to overcome, because we always have to confront the possibility that there are characteristics that are related both to marriage and to some beneficial outcome that are unobservable to researchers. but observable to the people who are deciding whether to marry. So it's really hard, if you want to be rigorous about it, to prove that marriage has these beneficial outcomes. But that said, I think it probably does have some causal role in good stuff that results. And briefly, this is how I think it works. Marriage facilitates investment. And it facilitates investment. It facilitates investment in adults and in children. And I'll just say a little about how that happens. How does it facilitate? One way it facilitates investment is that it makes it more likely that other people will invest in the project of the relationship that the couple has undertaken. In other words, you get more social support when you're married than if you're living together. Having lived with my wife, I realize that that actually is true. Right? People regard you differently if you're married. We lived together before we married. If you're married as opposed to living together, right? It signals something in our society, right? So that a father who is introduced to his daughter's boyfriend will not take as strong an interest in the boyfriend. If he will take a less strong interest in that person as a boyfriend than he would if that was his daughter's husband, right? As the daughter's boyfriend, maybe he'll counsel the young man about school and career prospects and decision making and different potential trajectories. But if that was his daughter's husband, he's going to work with the dead, right? He's going to come into the company and work with the dead. The dead is willing to then make a long-term investment in this young man because the young man and the daughter have made a long-term investment in each other. But if the father were to hire this guy to work at his company, and then the daughter and the boyfriend break up, it's trouble, right? So dad won't do that, right? Simple story, but that illustrates that people do invest. Families invest, communities invest, friends invest in the partners of people they have links with. And the degree of that investment, perhaps it depends in part on how permanent, stable, committed people perceive the investment to be, I mean the relationship to be. And in our society, it may be that marriage is used as a marker or a signal of a commitment so that people really do treat married couples differently than cohabitating couples. Now, not necessarily true everywhere. In other countries, things may be very different. But in our nation, that's the role that marriage plays. So marriage facilitates investment by third parties into the couple. It also facilitates investment by the parties themselves. And the intuitive way to think about this is that, you know, do we think that people would do more for their partner if they're planning on being with the partner for a long time compared to if they're just kind of, I don't know what the, see, this is where I show my own age. I don't know what the lingo is here. We used to say if they're kicking it, what's the hanging out, kicking it? It's probably some newer phrase that I don't know, right? But if they're the extreme, right, is if there's a hookup. Right? And people know that phrase. I know that one. I only know that phrase, in fact, because I have a colleague who's researching hookups, right? So I heard a paper about hookups. And then I had to go and ask my niece, who was a college student, so do you know about hookups? And, of course, she told me she had never participated in a hookup, but that she heard of hookups when she was a college student. But so if you're just hooking up or you're hanging out or you're kicking it or you're doing something like that, you don't have the same perspective towards your partner that you would if you knew that you're going to be in this long term. Right. So this is another way of saying that marriage facilitates partners' investments in each other, right? So you have a boyfriend who comes home or girlfriend who comes home from work and they're having some problem. You know, you talk about it and you want to work it out. You want them to do well, just like you would with your friend. But when you're married to that person and they have a problem at work, that has implications for you, right? Long-term implications for you. And you have every incentive to do everything you can to promote their career, right? to help them do well, because when they do well, you do well. And if they do poorly, you do poorly, right? That's the upside and the downside of marriage, right? But the consequence of that is that it does create incentives for people to support each other to a greater extent than they would if they were cohabitating. And there's actually a lot of research that's consistent with that, right? So on this account, one of the explanations for the increased income of men in particular, who tend to be in the work world full-time more so than women, one of the explanations for the increased income of men after they marry is that, well, they have wives who invest a lot in their careers. They invest a lot in their careers. You know, the husband is coming home and he's had some problem with the coworker and he doesn't know how to solve it. He's kind of a bonehead. You know, he just doesn't have that sensibility. And the wife kind of counsels him about what to do and how to get by and how to interact with these people and how to manage your boss, which all you law students, you will have to do, right? You manage your boss. And you have to figure out how to do that. And it's a whole lot easier to figure out how to do that if you have someone who wants you to succeed in every way, for whom your success is as important to them as it is to you, who's willing to work through that with you. So marriage helps to bring that about. And this, of course, has an advantage for children, because if these benefits are associated with marriage in some causal way, then it also means that children are going to benefit economically from their parents being married as well, right? Children benefit economically from marriage, and pretty intuitive to see that, you know, that's a good thing, to have more resources rather than fewer. Children also benefit, though, I think, because being raised by your parents who are married has psychological or emotional benefits for children as well. In short, I think that it helps. Parents help each other to invest in their children. Right? Parents help each other to invest in their children. So the example I have is I could a gazillion examples. So I have three kids at home, and, you know, if I'm sitting around with them and, you know, my wife's not there and we're just kind of sitting around and time for bed, I might just tell them, why don't you guys go to bed? This is the Lakers are playing the Celtics tonight and I need to finish watching this. But then if my wife is there, right, I mean, she's, like, aware of this, and, you know, all it takes is one question. Well, are you going to go up and read to Everett or Harlan? Are you going to go up and read to them? And I say, well, okay, I have to do that, right? So, you know, you do that, right? And maybe I actually wanted to do that anyway, but I forgot, right? And so I wasn't able to do that. And that happens, right? So we can think of this again. I mean, this is something that happens with all sorts of behaviors outside of the family. Right. I mean, if you have, speaking of my wife, so my wife's a psychology professor. And one of the tips she gives me to get students motivated, she says, don't have students write reaction papers that they just give to you. Have them write reaction papers that they read to the class, because if they have to read their reaction paper to the class, they're going to make it a better paper. Right. Because they don't want their classmates looking at them and thinking that they're kind of a laggard in some way. Same idea, right? When you know that other people are monitoring your behavior, people who are valuable to you, important to you, meaningful to you, they're monitoring your behavior, they're looking at you, they're making judgments, they give you little nudges at the right time, that actually does result in different behaviors than if you were just there on your own, right? Different behaviors than if you were just there on your own, right? And if you tried, you know, you try to take up jogging or try to lose weight or try to do anything, right, where you could either go either way, having a buddy there to nudge you along makes a big difference. And that's one of the things that happens with parents and children. And that happens best when you have two adults who are parents of the child, because now they both have an interest in nurturing the child. There is this odd finding, which Chris Abrams has alluded to, that when you have two adults but only one is the parent of the child, then things can get really screwy, right? So the way I describe that is that, you know, I have a cousin who's had three children and was divorced, you know, and then remarried. And someone says, well, how many children do you have? And she says, four. Right? She has three children. She's divorced. She remarries. Someone says, how many children do you have? She says, four. Did I get that right? Four. And that's what happens. is that when you remarry, right, the other partner becomes a, you know, almost competition. It's in competition with the children. So it's not that marriage is always good. But if we could focus on situations where you have parents of the same children, marriage does help the parents to each invest in the child in ways that are beneficial for the child. So that's the case for marriage, in brief. Let me just close by, giving some reasons of why, ultimately, I am wary of government efforts to promote marriage. Right, so marriage is a good thing. There's not enough of it. We would do well as a society, and African Americans would benefit in particular if there were more of it. And then the next question is, well, should government try to promote it? And there, I get a little queasy. First problem is that it's not clear the government really can increase marriage rates. There are lots of things that influence marriage rates. How many women versus men there are, the economic prospects of the men, women's attachment to the labor force, availability of birth control. I mean, a whole bunch of things influence marriage. It's not clear that government actually could increase marriage rates even if it wanted to. It's not clear that government could. But even if government could increase marriage rates, it's not clear that those marriages that result would offer the benefits that we typically associate with marriage. Right? I mean, we could really give people some strong incentives to marry, but if we do that, it's not clear that the sort of marriage they have, that their relationship would be the sort of relationship that would generate the benefits that are typically associated with marriage. Right? And you can easily imagine, you know, this setting of people who are together, but they don't really want to be together. They're married in name, but they don't have the relationship that we think of as a marriage. And the research, of course, shows that, you know, children actually don't benefit from any marriage, as you might intuit. Children benefit from marriages that are stable and low conflict, right? If they're about to kill each other and they're fighting all the time and there's a lot of discord, it may be better for that couple to not be married. Right? And so it's not clear that government efforts to promote marriage, even if they could increase marriage rates, would actually increase rates of the right types of marriage. They might really increase rates of marriages that we would prefer not to have not happened. But then finally, even if the government could increase marriage rates, and even if the government could increase marriage rates of the right types of marriage, of the right types of marriages, that is, marriages where the partners are committed to each other and invest in each other and are concerned about the welfare of their children, it would take some convincing, or one would have to persuade me, at least, that that is the best anti-poverty program. So it could be that it's a good thing, but it just might not be as good a thing as other efforts to help children and families, for example. Right? And there are a whole array of other efforts that we might use to help children and families. And we'd have to really compare the marginal benefit of each of these efforts. So ultimately, where I come out on the policy question, just to set the terms of the debate here, is that I think it is a good thing. I think it's an easy case to support those who decide to marry. Right? When people decide to marry, should they be supported in that decision? Yes. Should there be premarital counseling that's available? Yes. Should people be able to talk with counselors on an ongoing basis or to receive support, advice, guidance about child rearing, managing conflict within their relationship? Yes, those would be wonderful things if we had more services available for people who decide to marry and think the services would help them. Those would be good things. I don't think, and we should also, of course, goes without saying, we should remove obstacles to marriage to the extent we have disincentives to marriage so that people might want to marry but don't feel they can. That's a bad thing. Right? I mean, I even have, and this happens with young people, right? We talk about it typically with the welfare system and various rules about rules that govern families with young children, but it even happens with older people, you know. So we maybe other people in this room also have an old aunt or maybe a mother who would actually like to marry someone, but then if you do, you lose some benefits, and so they can't get married, right? You know, nothing worse than very religious 72-year-old people living together in sin, right? Because they need those benefits. But that's what happens all the time, right? We should remove those sorts of obstacles so that these people who want to marry can marry. So I think that's what we should do. Support those who want to marry, remove obstacles. I have qualms, though, about the wisdom of any efforts that would push people into marriage or that would lock people into a marriage once they decide to divorce. In those cases, it's hard to, you know, again, children are going to be benefited if you have a really bad marriage that's splitting up. And I think we can trust people to know when they have a really bad marriage and they need to split up. I don't think people undertake divorce lightly. They know when they need to split. And if they know when they need to split and they want to do it, they should be allowed to do that. All we do, if we try to keep them together, is not, you know, help them maintain a relationship. It just stops them from starting a new relationship that, in fact, could result in a good marriage. So those are my, that's my perspective. Let me just, so that's my talk. Let me just respond. Can I start and then we'll just to get the ball rolling here on questions? One comment about each of my previous speakers. So Professor Abrams says a shortage of men leads to many black women not being able to marry. And this is true, right? And I mean, I think it would be a good idea to decrease incarceration rates, as you suggested, and that would lead to higher rates of marriage. That is true, and that would be a good thing. But the decrease in incarceration rates is probably not going to happen anytime soon. So in the short term, what to do? Well, one thing that should happen is for African-American women to increase the rate at which they marry people who are non-black. Currently, African-American women are the least likely, and this is, you know, again, we have this big marriage gap, and then we have a gap in interracial marriage with African-American women at the bottom. African-American women are the least likely of all groups to intermarry, of all minority groups. Black men are 2 to 3 times as likely to intermarry as black women. African-American women are substantially less likely than Asian women or Latino women to intermarry. And there, again, a difference is a magnitude 2 to 3 times greater rate of intermarriage among other minority group women. It would be a good thing if more African-American women married non-black men. A big part of the reason they don't marry is because, marry interracially, is because they feel that they need to be loyal, faithful, committed to the group. And they desert themselves by expressing that sort of commitment. And they deserve African-Americans as a group as well. So I'll try to get controversial there. And there could. And there's every possibility that for African-American women to marry more interracially. They can do that. But no, black men feel little loyalty. They do. I mean, black men feel little loyalty to the group. And this goes back to, this is the issue of men not African-American men are not committed to the group in the same way African-American women are in the family. And we can have a longer conversation about this, but you know, one way to think about it is that, you know, is this kind of like, I think it's kind of like what happened in the 19th century, where white men were basically concerned about the sanctity of the white race. At least that's what they said, right? But the result was that they put a huge responsibility on white women to maintain the sanctity of the race. So white women became the embodiment of white nationalism, in a sense, right? White women needed to be protected from black men, needed to be secure, needed to be placed on a pedestal. We had to preserve their femininity, their womanhood, because that was a stand-in, a marker for the white race more generally. That's what happened in the 19th century. What's happened since the civil rights era here is something very similar to that, where all the changes in our society suggest that African-American women should be marrying people of all different races, right? But in fact, they don't. And I think part of it is that we see the same dynamic with African-American women now that we saw with white women then. And the great irony and tragedy of it is that it's intensified by our worries, our concern, by the problems with African-American families. That is, the higher the lack of the non-marriage rate goes for African-American families, the more desire, at least many black women may feel, to find a black man and create the strong black family that's missing. And part of the reason they feel that is because of all the stories we tell ourselves about the centrality of women, the centrality of family, and the role of women in maintaining the family, and how the family is a stand-in or a proxy for the group itself. Same sort of dynamic now that we saw in the 19th century. Then it was with whites, now it's with blacks. So that's the short story about that. And on the problem, Chief Justice Sears raised the issue of men not committing to their families. Yeah. And here, this is a problem that has... is a huge issue, right? Like, why don't these people get married? Right? And in our society, not in some places you could imagine people not being married. In many European countries, marriage rates are fairly low, but the stability of families is fairly high. Marriage means something different there, right? But in our family, marriage is a pretty good proxy for commitment to the other adult. And so the question is, well, why don't men commit to women that they have children with? And part of the story there is, again, this numbers imbalance. When you have very few men and very many women, who do we think has the stronger hand in the negotiation that is the relationship? Right? I mean, and you could think about it if you're... So that's the issue.
I guess the question is, but they're not committing to their children.
Right.
It's not a game between the man right. and the woman. They're failing to commit to their children.
Well, here's the problem, is that you can't, so let me just emphasize. So the first point is that the sex ratios, the shortage of men and the abundance of women in comparison, if we imagine a segregated dating market, leads to an imbalance where the women don't get the men to marry them because, in short, the men have, there's just too much out there, right? As Chris Rock says, a man is as faithful as his options. And I don't often reference Chris Rock, but this is a case where that is applicable. So then the question is, well, why don't the men commit to their children? And the problem there is that it actually is extraordinarily difficult to commit to a child without committing to the child's mother. And why is that? Well, the child is not going to, arrange to see you on his or her own, right? Now, how do we think a mother who's not real pleased with the father of her child, how do we think she's going to interact with him, right? Do we think she's going to really facilitate that relationship between the father of the child and the child? Easy to see how the poor relationship between the adults can impede the relationship between the absent parent and the child, even if the father really, 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 really wants to be a good father. It's going to be really difficult for him to do so as long as the relationship with the mom is impaired. So, you want to open it up for questions?